From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Reports are the Trump administration will soon formally propose denying citizenship to permanent legal residents who've used public benefits. Currently receiving cash welfare typically disqualifies, but the new proposal would extend that to people getting ACA subsidies and other benefits. Is that fair to legal residents seeking citizenship? We'll debate it.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us wherever you are in Southern California, whether listening through our KPCC app or 89.3. Coming up, yesterday President Trump tweeted in favor of more logging in California forests. The federal government is moving forward on a plan to allow logging of pine trees in the massive Los Padres National Forest northwest of Los Angeles. We'll debate whether thinning the forest will increase its health and improve fire protection. But first, several major news organizations report the Trump administration will soon release its proposal to tighten rules for citizenship and for receiving green cards. Currently, permanent legal residents are eligible for many forms of public assistance. Most haven't created problems for people wanting to become citizens. Only cash welfare benefits have typically been a barrier. The idea is that if people are going to become citizens, they should be financially able to take care of themselves. However, the question is, in taking benefits, to what degree is that going to disqualify people who are looking to change their status? Joining us to talk about this proposal, which is expected to soon be published, is Jessica Vaughn, Director of Policy Studies at the Center for Immigration Studies in D.C. Jessica, thank you for being with us again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So this NBC story that came out early today mentions the extension of this to people who are seeking citizenship. Can you comment on this? Because permanent legal residents are eligible for many benefits.
That's right. Immigrants who have been in the country for 5 years or more are eligible for benefits, the full range of benefits. But my understanding is that these proposed new rules will not apply to those who are already permanent residents, people with green cards who are seeking to become citizens, that they will not be subjected to these rules. These rules are intended to govern those who are applying for a green card or an immigrant visa and people who are applying to come here on a temporary basis, for example, as a student or a guest worker or something like this. And it does not apply to people seeking to become citizens, and it wouldn't apply to anyone here in a humanitarian category, such as a refugee or asylum seeker.
So someone who's seeking to come here on a visa, haven't they historically had to be financially independent for that status anyway, unless they were a refugee?
Well, the law has always said that only those who are not going to be what's called a public charge or someone dependent in large part on the government for their support can be admitted under any category except for a humanitarian category. Rules have been put in place to interpret what the law says, and over the years, some loopholes have been built in, most recently to say that this public charge rule only applies to people who've been getting cash benefits for their income support. It has never in the past been applied to things like housing assistance, fuel assistance, food stamps, and other things. And as I understand it, the proposal that the Trump administration is making is to widen the range of things that could be considered disqualifying types of public support. So people who have been dependent on those things, and this will be decided on a case-by-case basis, but people who've been dependent on programs like that may find that they're no longer eligible. Of course, if their sponsor's income is enough to outweigh their dependency, that is something that could offset that. So it's going to be, you know, every case is going to be different. But this could affect a lot of people who are seeking to qualify for a green card or an immigrant visa if their family income is not sufficient for them to survive.
The other question is those who have children who are U.S. citizens, they're born here, and those kids who are getting benefits, and I know education isn't included in this, that wouldn't be disqualifying kid going to public school. But if they're getting some other sorts of benefits, could that then disqualify even though the child's a citizen?
Probably not, because if, for example, someone is, institutionalized and they're a U.S. citizen, it's hard to see how that would affect the parent's ability to become a green card holder, for example, because of other provisions in the law that allow for people to be admitted, you know, because of a hardship on a U.S. citizen. So I don't think it would apply in a lot of those cases. But again, it's going to have to be decided on a case-by-case basis. And there's no kind of one-size-fits-all rule to this. What they're looking to see is that applicants for green cards and immigrant visas are not going to be mostly dependent on the government and on taxpayers to survive here. The idea is not necessarily to reduce the number of immigrants coming here, but to make sure that the ones that we are admitting from an oversubscribed system are the ones that are going to be self-sufficient.
We're talking with the Center for Immigration Studies Director of Policy Studies, Jessica Vaughn. Also with us is Alvaro Huerta, staff attorney for the National Immigration Law Center, which is based here in Los Angeles. Mr. Huerta, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
So as you read the reports of this, what's your sense of how sweeping, you know, these kinds of new rules might be?
This proposed regulation by the administration is incredibly sweeping. It would really, really turn everything on its head in terms of the way that we've approached this idea of public charge in the past, and would really affect many, up to millions of immigrant families and their children, and ultimately affects all communities, right? When you're not allowing folks to integrate into society by becoming lawful permanent residents and citizens, you're really denying communities of the people there, the people power that they could have.
So let's take an example, if you will, of someone who you think, you know, gets public benefits of some sort, but wouldn't necessarily, in your view, be burdensome, and who should be eligible for permanent legal residency or citizenship?
Well, here's an example. So the proposed change in law is so sweeping that it would include anyone who gets subsidized health care as a potential public charge. And from what we know of the Affordable Care Act, people up to 400% of the poverty line can get subsidized health care. So you're talking about not even necessarily the poorest of the poor, but that the fact that they're using subsidized health care could be used against them. But then you are talking about folks who do need, the occasional use of benefits, you know, especially with the Great Recession that we've just been by. The American public understands that at some time in people's lives, you may need to use benefits. That doesn't mean you're going to stay on them forever, but you may need help to get by. This would make it incredibly difficult setting up this terrible choice for a lot of immigrants where they have to decide whether they're going to use some of those benefits to provide for their families and thereby put their immigration applications in jeopardy or go by without taking care of their children and their families.
Jessica, do you know if historically food stamps have been considered disqualifying cash benefits, or what category has that been in?
No, typically receiving food stamp benefits was not something that would disqualify someone for immigration here. And that's because usually people qualify for those on a temporary basis. And again, it's how long people use them that would be the factor deciding whether it should be counted. But I want to make something very clear. My understanding of the rule is that this would only apply to people who start receiving benefits after the final rule is in place.
Oh, it would not be retroactive. Okay.
Correct. And I think that's very important for people to understand that they should not allow sort of fear of what this rule might say to affect applying for benefits that they need now.
Well, because that seemed unfair if you're telling people, well, here's the rules. You can accept this type of benefit, not this. And then people take benefits that have not been a barrier in the past and then say, well, no, now that's, you know, retroactively a barrier. You got a big fairness issue there.
Okay. Exactly. And I hope the advocacy community will be very clear in communicating that to people that they deal with. I think that's very important.
But Mr. Huerta, it sounds like you think this could be retroactively applied.
No, from what we've seen of the leaked versions from earlier this year, it sounds like it will be a forward-looking test, which it always has been. The public charge test has always been forward-looking. Will you be a charge to the federal government in the future? So I don't think this will change that. Of course, that doesn't prevent folks from misunderstanding. And unfortunately, there is this huge chilling effect, which I think is actually what the administration is trying to get to more than anything else, is to chill the use of these benefits by immigrant family members. And we've heard stories of folks not showing up to healthcare appointments, asking to be dropped off of food stamps, and other programs that have been lifelines for them.
I'd like to hear from listeners. What do you think about this? Do you think that it should be exclusionary to legal permanent residency if people have been receiving public benefits other than cash welfare payments? We're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. I don't know if if you're someone who looked at bringing family members here, for example, and it might not be really clear what their means of support would be upon arrival. Is this something you think would have an effect on that? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Mr. Huerta, what kind of legal advice are you giving to those who are here in the country about how to deal with this? Should people try and expedite their efforts to get green cards, but before new rules go into effect? What should people do?
I think if folks are in the process of getting their green cards, they should do whatever they need to get that process going. And we actually need to demand that the administration move those applications forward. There's a huge right now citizenship application backlog for citizenship applications, even though that wouldn't be affected by these public charge changes. It just shows how the administration has been slow walking a lot of applications. So yes, folks in the process should continue in the process, and folks who are on benefits programs, as Ms. Vaughn said, should continue to stay on them. That also helps ultimately the family not only provide for themselves, but to show, it could actually show that they aren't going to be a public charge. For example, if they're healthy, they're going to be able to go to work and go to school. And so we're asking folks to continue to use the benefits that they need. Nothing has changed, at least when it comes to folks who are in the country. And as was mentioned, this is going to be a forward-looking change. Hopefully it doesn't even get to that, but if it does, it won't affect the use of benefits in the past.
Sal in Long Beach asks, what about unemployment insurance? Does that factor in? Alvaro, my assumption is because that is insurance, employers pay into it, that would not be considered a public benefit. Is that right?
That's right. From at least the versions that we've seen so far, unemployment insurance is kind of an earned benefit and is not included.
All right. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Jessica Vaughn, there have been written copies of this proposal, the different news organizations. I think the Washington Post a couple months ago got a copy of this. What is your understanding about the delay in the administration actually putting this out for public comment?
Well, I think that's because there's a certain amount of deliberation that's going to go along with any change in policy that's significant as this one is, and they need to make sure that the agencies are ready to implement the changes, that they can anticipate what the objections might be and whether or not the original proposal is going to work, how it needs to be tweaked. And this is all part of good policymaking, that they, instead of rushing into something like this, that they're taking their time to get it right.
All right. I want to thank you both for being with us. Jessica Vaughn, Director of Policy Studies at the Center for Immigration Studies in D.C. Alvaro Huerta is Staff Attorney for the National Immigration Law Center. That's a D.C.-based organization, but Mr. Huerta practicing here in Los Angeles. You can share your comments about this expected proposal on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Yesterday, President Trump tweeted about the historically large California wildfires. He mentioned California water policy and environmental rules being a contributor, but he also talked about the need to thin forests for fire protection. In fact, there are proposals for the Los Padres National Forest, the huge forest just northwest of Los Angeles, starting in Ventura County, going through Santa Barbara County and well up to the north. We'll hear the pros and cons of the thinning of forests for fire suppression back in just 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Yesterday, President Trump tweeted about California's wildfires. One of the lines in the tweet was about the importance of thinning forests and that role in preventing large fires. It's a very controversial issue, whether you're talking about thinning dead trees and removing them or taking perfectly healthy trees out of forests to reduce the amount of fuel. Well, the federal government is proposing commercial logging in the massive Los Padres National Forest north of L.A. This would be the first time in many, many years that that logging was done. The U.S. Forest Service wants to remove sagebrush as well as take down Jeffrey and Ponderosa pines across nearly 3,000 acres of the forest. The plan also includes a 12-mile-long firebreak along Tocuya Ridge and removal of trees there. So the question is this in the best interests of safety? And secondly, what about the environmental effects on habitat if that amount of trees were to be removed? Joining us is John D. Bailey, Professor of Silviculture and Fire Management at Oregon State University. Welcome, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, what do you see as the potential risk in taking large numbers of trees out of a forest like this?
Well, the risk is it's an alteration to the environment. It's something that you're balancing against, you know, all the other needs and expectations for those hillsides. So when we look at the hillsides, yes, you know, they're wildlife habitat, they're watersheds and watershed protection. It's timber, it's fiber, it's carbon, it's scenery, it's spiritual value, but it's also fuel. And so you balance this fuel dynamic against all of the other concerns you have for that hillside.
And when we've discussed this issue in the past, my recollection is one of the challenges with only taking out dead fuel is that it's very expensive to do that. There's no sort of way to pay for it. Is one of the arguments for thinning taking out the healthy trees, in addition to the ability of creating a fire break, that you make it economically feasible to take the dead stuff out too?
Exactly, because if it is only the smallest dead things, it's completely a cost. As you move up into things that actually have value, and some of that's timber value, but it also could be a biomass market or other niche markets. But it's hard to make a lot of money that way. You typically have to get up into larger diameter trees, things that have a substantial amount of dollar value to make a sale, you know, actually profitable to the landowner. Of course, the landowner in this case is the federal government. And so, you know, in my experience, federal government doesn't necessarily want to make money, but there are only so many hundreds to thousands of dollars per acre that they can afford with their budgets in order to just treat the hillside. So they're trying to offset those costs a little bit.
How important a factor do you think it is of thinning of forests. How much of a difference maker can that be in preventing massive fires?
Yeah, again, you know, these trees, this community, the layers, it's all fuel. And fuel is one side of the what we call the fire behavior triangle. So the weather and the climate is one side, the fuel is one side, and the topography is one side. And if you have a handle on the fuel, topography, and weather interactions, you can do a pretty good job of projecting future fire behavior. So, you know, the fuel is about the only thing we can change. I mean, we can anticipate weather conditions and climate patterns and those kind of things. The topography is pretty well set. But we can actually manage the fuel out there. And if you think back to our ancestors with the Jeffrey pine, ponderosa pine forest types that you have down in that part of the world, they managed the fuel levels, you know, on those hillsides very effectively with fire itself largely, or at least that was probably 90% of the biomass removal on a
controlled burns you're talking about?
Excuse me?
Controlled burns you're talking about?
Yes, I'm not sure they necessarily. They saw it as ecological burning, maybe, rather than controlled burning or prescribed burning. But now that the world has changed and there's so many more humans around, yes, we think of it as prescribed burning or controlled burning, in addition to mechanical treatment. Because the other thing to remember, other than just the money element, is that, you know, our society needs, you know, wood fiber. There's only so much we can do with steel and concrete and plastic and all that kind of stuff. This is wood is a wonderful, you know, renewable natural resource that can be used to meet a lot of society's needs.
We're talking with Oregon State University Professor John D. Bailey, also with us from Colorado State University Associate Professor of Geography Jason Seibold. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What are your concerns about thinning of forests like this? What do you see as creating more harm than benefit in that process?
Well, I think that thinning can play a role. I think that we need to think about it as a targeted kind of a treatment and be logical about where we're doing that on the landscape. That obviously it's going to have the greatest impact for, you know, homeowners and safety of people and structures if you target that on the landscape close to communities. So we can also think about this in terms of the community side of the equation and where we're living and how we're living and the density of homes. So kind of the worst case scenario is, you know, a lot of fuels and a lot of houses spread out across a very large landscape. And in that kind of a situation, you know, you can imagine that this is a worst case kind of scenario for wildland firefighters, that, you know, there are a lot of structures to protect and they're spread out. So we need to also, I think about the flip side about how we're developing and where we're developing our communities. If we can be compact in our development, then a fire break around a community can do a lot more good in terms of saving people and wildland firefighters and structures and all sorts of things. The other thing is that, you know, when we think about thinning, the vast majority of our acres that are burned are in years like this. So the fires that California has been experiencing and throughout the West this year, as well as over the last about 15 to 20 years, the vast majority of acres that burn are in these extreme weather scenarios. And under those type of weather scenarios, thinning can only go so far. And yes, it can modify behavior. It can help things out. But oftentimes you would have to thin these forests to such an extreme to be able to limit fire behavior and spread under those situations where we can get things under control and safely put wildland firefighters into these situations to influence fire spread and save structures and things of that nature, that I'm not sure that, you know, we have the capacity to thin forests to that nature or to that degree. And I'm not sure that society wants to do that. We're oftentimes moving to these areas because we like the aesthetics and we like the natural landscapes. We don't necessarily want to be in a nearly kind of, you know, cleared out forest setting, that we still want some trees out there. We also need to think about, you know, these forests are adapting to shifting climate just as we are starting to adapt to shifting climate. And we also have to be very cautious that we don't add one more insult to these forests as they're trying to adapt to this very rapidly warming climate.
Professor, what about in logging itself? the ecological challenge if you're bringing heavy equipment in and doing logging. Let's say you're putting in a big, a fire buffer, for example. Just to get the equipment in, I know, you can use helicopters to take the trees out, et cetera, but isn't there unintentional damage that's also done in the process?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a concern. I think, forestry and silviculture has come a long way, and they're pretty knowledgeable about how to minimize those impacts at this point in time. But that's obviously a concern, as well as just, hey, when you go in and you reset conditions and you're going into these forests, there's also opportunities for more invasives to come in to alter other things that we may not be necessarily wanting to do, all these potential unintended consequences that could result from that. Another unintended consequence that we saw oftentimes in the U.S. West in the Rockies was thinning to influence fire behavior and leaving a lot of large diameter trees on the landscape. And that just set these stands up for bark beetle infestations and oftentimes increased the severity of bark beetle infestation. So we have a lot of moving parts in this landscape at this point in time. And if you try to strengthen and harden your landscape and your forest against one thing by leaving large fire-resistant trees, you may be kind of pushing it to a more susceptible position for other ecological disturbances like drought or bark beetles.
Jason Seibold, a Colorado State University professor, John D. Bailey, professor at Oregon State University. Professor Bailey, are there ways to effectively mitigate the environmental harms that come with logging?
Yeah, Jason mentioned that the profession has come a long ways for minimizing the effects of the roads, the equipment. We have new systems and all that kind of stuff for it. But undeniably, it's still a disturbance to the system, and so it has to be very sound and modern practices. We don't want to go back to the abusive practices of our past. We do have to anticipate climate change, as Jason was talking about. We have a whole host of new invasive exotic species to worry about. There are more humans out there all the time, which is another issue that we have to deal with. So, a lot of the future, that I see is, in the realm of adaptive management. We're just going to have to try new things, try to learn from them as we go, because the last year, this year is teaching us that just keeping our heads down and hoping that things are going to get better just isn't going to work.
Is there eventually a point where so much of California has burned over the years of these massive fires that a lot of the load that's built up over decades is gone? And that you've burned so much over time that the fires start diminishing in intensity and size.
Yes, but it has the subsequent influence of actually changing the ecosystems, which may be on a trajectory to change anyway because of climate change. But fire becomes the disturbance process that makes these sudden jumps to shift a forest to a shrubland, a shrubland to a grassland, or those kinds of things. So we have to anticipate and try potentially to mitigate those kind of changes as well. Because, as Jason mentioned, the public has a certain expectation for the areas that they're familiar with, and we've kind of built an expectation that it's not going to burn, That's in the past. We have to realize that in some shape, these hillsides are going to burn, and start thinking about how we might alter them now to make them more resistant and resilient to the future fires. We know that wildfire has done a lot of the work for us already. We'll continue to do a lot of this work, and so we might even choose some of the timing of that burning so that even wildfire can do some of this work for us, because it's many, many hundreds of thousands of acres that we still need to lower the amount of fuel.
Well, it's funny because I recall in years past we've had these debates about let burn versus fire suppression. These fires are so big, there's no chance to even have that debate.
Exactly.
You can't suppress them.
What happens is, we We can put them out under very modest weather conditions, and so we typically do that, you know, being risk averse. Since we can put it out, we do put it out. When in reality, that kicks the can down the road.
Yeah.
Kind of conditions where we can't put them out.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for being with us. That's Oregon State's Professor John D. Bailey from Colorado State, Jason Seibold with us as well. We're talking about the Trump administration's proposal to do logging in the Los Padres National Forest from Ventura County north up into the heart of California. Coming up, we'll take a look at a proposal for rezoning along the Orange Line, the transit line in the San Fernando Valley. What kinds of changes might that bring to residential communities along the route? We'll be back after this live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. As you know, as a regular listener to the program, we talk a lot about rezoning around transit hubs, putting in denser, taller residential so that those corridors can not only create more housing, but encourage more people to use public transit. Well, there's a proposal that the L.A. City Council is looking at to create a development corridor along the Metro Orange Line. That's an 18-mile bus rapid transit line. It starts at the Chatsworth Metrolink station in the northwest San Fernando Valley and goes all the way to the North Hollywood Metro Red Line station, 18 miles. It's one of the busiest bus rapid transit lines in the country, with an average of 30,000 passengers on that line every weekday. But the question is, if zoning is changed along the Orange Line to allow for taller, denser residential construction, what will be the effects on the residential and existing business districts along the way? Is this a good way to create more units of housing, or is it going to have the unintended consequence of having a negative effect on some of the communities along the route? Joining us to talk about this proposal is Stuart Waldman, president of the Valley Industry and Commerce Association, a nonprofit representing Valley businesses. Stuart, good to have you with us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what's the case for rezoning and allowing this densification?
Well, we need more housing. We are trying to encourage people to get out of their cars, but so we're doing transit-oriented development. And the Orange Line is just a perfect place that hasn't taken off, that hasn't really developed much, that we're talking neighborhoods that are middle-class neighborhoods that need more multifamily housing, and we're going to be able to do quite a bit to encourage families to move in. We're going to be able to build affordable housing, mixed use, as well as some other upper market housing.
Do you see North Hollywood as an example of this model? Because there's been all the development, of course, around the Red Line station.
Yeah, North Hollywood 25 years ago was a much different area. And when you put in the Orange Line and the Red Line, it changed the NoHo District. And the NoHo District was really damaged from the earthquake, and I think it's made it better.
All right. Stuart Waldman, the Valley Industry and Commerce Association, also with us, the executive director of the Coalition to Preserve L.A., nonprofit organization that's put measures on the ballot dealing with housing. Jill Stewart with us. Jill, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. What are your concerns about rezoning this corridor?
Well, our concerns are always get back to the city's transparency in doing strategic planning. And this is, I think, a case of really moving quickly on a plan that isn't going to unfold for probably another 30 years as far as the upgrades to transit. So if the fixed rail comes in with the switch from buses to transit, it will probably be 30, maybe even 40 years down the road when they do this. But the denser, taller buildings, which will almost exclusively be luxury housing, that's what the city's been bringing in. We call it luxury blight because we're very, very critical of Metro and the city's ability to create affordable housing, which has been a tremendous failure. So we're basically very skeptical of the city's grand plans. We're also very, very skeptical of Metro's ability to attract riders with its theories, because as you've discussed on the show, and I think all of the media are now writing about and broadcasting about, Metro's plunging ridership. They're back down to 1985 levels because of this, I think we can fairly say right now, this obsession with luxury housing around the Metro stops. And when they added 10% affordable housing, it still creates massive amounts of luxury housing around the stops. And people who drive beautiful cars are not using Metro. So we're losing ridership, I believe, around 65,000 riders a year. And I'm spending a lot, we're all spending a lot, on the fixed rail lines, and we're not getting anything back. In other words, we're not getting people out of their cars.
On the cost of the housing itself, it sounds like you don't buy the argument that even if these are largely luxury units, that that provides at least some relief to, you know, middle income or lower income housing, because as you create more units, even at the high end, there is a benefit overall. You don't buy that.
Well, not only do I not buy it, but I think the piece that swept the globe this week in Forbes and the big study out now showing that the luxury trickle-down theory is backfiring in all the major cities is real. And, you know, it's not working out. The idea that luxury housing somehow trickles down and helps the middle class is backfiring in all the major cities, from Sydney to Vancouver to San Francisco to Los Angeles. And, you know, thanks to Forbes for really, you know, explaining why and talking about the huge study that's out showing it doesn't work. And it's important, I think, for the media to get that story out there and everybody to have a rediscussion about how that concept took hold. You know, if you have a lot of carrots for sale, yes, the price of carrots drops. But if you have a lot of luxury housing for sale, you end up with a luxury housing glut. We call it luxury blight in Los Angeles, and no, it's not working. So
all right,
what the discussion needs to be is about that instead of Metro's latest plan for more luxury housing.
Jill Stewart of the Coalition to Preserve LA with us, Stuart Waldman of VICA, the Valley Industry and Commerce Association. Also with us is Paul Storiali, who's the president of the NoHo Neighborhood Council. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What are your concerns about this? I mean, particularly since you've seen your neighborhood dramatically altered over the past 20 years.
Yeah, I certainly have. At our board meeting on August 13th, we're going to hear from our stakeholders and see what their opinions are about this. We haven't yet discussed it, but the folks from the plan are going to be there to speak with them, and we're going to have a discussion about it next Wednesday. What I have been hearing is some folks are fearful. They fear that what the plans will do to their beloved blocks, parking. We already have a very large parking problem. They're giving, you know, we had a lot of parking requirements that the city is ignoring. So they're putting in bars all over our area. We've got 8 brand new bars on one very small street already within the last 5 years, and none of them have to have parking. That's our biggest concern, is parking. You know, we keep hearing this fantasy of bike riding to work. It's never going to happen. People don't move to LA to work at a Subway sandwich shop in a mall above a train station. And I think the people who do work at a sandwich shop aren't going to be living in the buildings that they're building there, because they won't make enough money unless, of course, they have 5 people living in a 1-bedroom apartment, which is, you know, what everyone's doing now. They're turning dining rooms and living rooms into bedrooms just to be able to afford rent in this area.
All right, we'll continue. Paul Storiali with us, president of the NoHo Neighborhood Council, Jill Stewart, Coalition to Preserve LA, Stuart Waldman, VICA with us. I'd like to hear from you if you're a San Fernando Valley resident, particularly if you live in one of the communities that abuts the Orange Bus Line. I'd like to hear what you think about this proposal to rezone that corridor for denser, taller housing development. If you live in Canoga Park, in Woodland Hills, West Hills, Reseda, Van Nuys, North Hollywood. What do you think about this proposal? How would you see it affecting the quality of life as well as creating housing units in L.A.? 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. We'll continue in just 1 minute. Pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Our focus right now on the North San Fernando Valley, the route along which the Orange Metro Busway goes. Currently, there's a proposal to rezone that corridor so that additional housing units could be constructed along its length, all the way from Chatsworth to North Hollywood. Taller, denser construction, some of this single-family residential neighborhoods. The question is, what effect would it have on the nearby neighborhoods, the businesses that are operating there, as well as the communities, residential communities of the valley? I'd like to hear from you if you are a resident of that area. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Hugo writes on the page, Bill, San Gabriel Valley writes, in the D.C. area, general rule, housing near a D.C. metro station always more expensive than housing far from a station won't work for the Orange Line either. Hugo writes on the page, did I just hear a complaint about luxury blight? Housing for net taxpayers is no limit to the outrage. 866-893-KPECC. Let me go back to Stuart Waldman of the Valley Industry and Commerce Association. Stuart, you want to respond to what Jill and Paul were just saying?
Yeah, well, you know, mainly Jill. It's, you know, ridiculous to imply that all of this housing is going to be luxury. We're talking about Van Nuys. I live in Van Nuys. No disrespect to Van Nuys, but Van Nuys is not going to be the next Studio City. You are not going to see people, you know, in luxury cars driving there. The whole goal of this plan is to put more affordable housing. And Jill knows very well that Metro requires 35% of housing to be affordable. LA City requires at least 10% to be affordable. This density will benefit everyone. And unfortunately, there are people in the city of LA who just don't want to build anything. And when you don't build, it gets more expensive. The best way to lower costs for market rate housing is to build more.
All right, let's take a listener call. Studio City resident Kale joining us. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to make a comment and kind of hear your thoughts on this. As a Studio City resident, I never use the Orange Line, and part of the reason I never use it is it's so far away from all the commercial that's along Ventura Boulevard. It can be a fairly substantial walk to that for a good chunk of that. So I'm not entirely sure how really expanding that line is going to warrant people taking it unless they're taking it all the way to Hollywood and downtown. So just love to hear your comment on that.
All right, Kale, thanks very much. Well, this sort of gets to Jill Stewart's point that she thinks the ridership is in decline. Jill, you want to quickly comment on Kale's point?
Well, you know, they chose it not because it was a good route, but because they had the right-of-way to put the line there. It was a pre-existing right-of-way from an older rail. So it wasn't chosen for strategic intelligence, but because they had the land. I would like to say something about the purpose of, you know, that Van Nuys won't be gentrified. I'm sorry, but I have to strongly disagree. The plan is to gentrify and push people, especially Latino families, I would say, out of Van Nuys. The clearances that happened in North Hollywood, let's not forget them. They will be written about in some history book at some point. My mechanic, his family, his grandparents, they were all shoved out of North Hollywood. Let's not forget that people, poor people and low-income people, were removed from North Hollywood by the redevelopment agency. It was a really brutal period in city history, and I think it was, you know, a terrible thing that happened to a lot of low-income people, and they were, you know, they were not wanted. They weren't wanted there. It was a, you know, it was considered a rundown, horrible place, and it's beautiful now.
Jill, your thought is that the demand for housing at the high end as well as other levels, is just so high. The developers are not going to be willing to build anything other than luxury apartments along the route?
I'm saying that Metro and the city always promise affordable housing, and then they don't deliver. That's not what ends up happening.
All right. Nicole in Valley Village says, I live in a four-bedroom apartment with other students along the Orange Line. We like that it's bikeable and quaint, but if you build, it's going to take away that charm. Also, I'm afraid it's going to get more expensive. That's Nicole in Valley Village. Stuart Waldman of the Valley Industry and Commerce Association, your response to her concern.
If you build, it is going to improve the neighborhoods. It is going to bring more jobs. It is going to put money into the economy, and it is definitely going to make change. And as Jill pointed out, the people who are living in North Hollywood now probably would not have been willing to live in North Hollywood 25 years ago when it was blighted. And with change comes good things. There's a lot of business in North Hollywood that there wasn't before the Red Line was built.
Chris in Tarzana says, I agree parking is a huge issue. Parking in neighborhoods near the Red Line is insane, and those units don't even provide enough parking to the residents. So echoing the thoughts of the NoHo Neighborhood Council President Paul Storiali, who's with us as well. Let's talk with Cheryl in North Hollywood. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yes, I live in North Hollywood, and I've seen the construction that's gone up. I think it's great. It's really transformed it. But I think it's important for listeners to know, if they don't, that the Orange Line you're talking about is a bus, and it's not going to have the same response that it will, you know, that a train will. It doesn't turn into the Red Line until it gets to North Hollywood and becomes a subway. The same people that live in those luxury units would ride the subway in New York, in Chicago, in San Francisco, but they're not going to get on a bus.
All right, Cheryl, I appreciate it. Well, the Orange Line busway has been a very, very popular mode of transportation, even with the decline of ridership in Metro Public Transit. Stuart, you want to respond to Cheryl that people that are going to move into these buildings aren't going to ride the bus?
Yeah, well, you know, I think the people who move into the buildings are going to be moving there specifically to ride it's a bus rapid transit, and there are upgrades that are coming to it starting next year, shovels in the ground. It is going to make it faster. It's going to shave about 25% of the time it takes to go from one end of the valley to the other end of the valley. There's going to be grade crossings, and eventually we are going to get a train there, hopefully sooner rather than later, but it is scheduled to come. And yes, the people who move there aren't going to be expecting a train. They're going to know that it's the BRT.
All right. Phil Washington, by the way, the director of Metro, is going to be with us tomorrow for an extended conversation. He comes and joins us regularly on the program. We'll hear what Phil has to say. The CEO always with a lot on his mind about public transit, a number of big challenges for the agency. That's tomorrow on Air Talk in our first hour. My thanks to Stuart Waldman. He's the president of the Valley Industry and Commerce Association, known as VICA. Jill Stewart, executive director, Coalition to Preserve LA, and Paul Storiali, president of the NoHo Neighborhood Council. You can share your comments about this proposal to rezone along the Orange bus line in the North San Fernando Valley to allow for denser and taller residential construction. AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We have much to talk about coming up in the second hour, including a look at tech platforms clamping down on Alex Jones and his InfoWars sites.
KPCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, helping businesses improve their bottom line with solar water heating. The system preheats your water using the strength of the sun. It works with your existing natural gas water heater to warm your water in a reliable and efficient way. You may save on your SoCal Gas bill and get rebates that may cover up to 80% of the system's cost. With these rebates, heating water with the sun could be a sound investment. It's the strength of the sun in your business. Learn more at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Later this hour, we'll get an update on what's happening with the Orange County homeless population who were evicted from the riverbanks of the Santa Ana River. Judge David Carter has been overseeing what happens to the more than 200 homeless people there for while they were housed in local motels. We'll talk about their futures coming up a lot on housing on today's edition of Air Talk. And we continue in that vein. Los Angeles Times editorial writer Carla Hall wrote a piece in the latest issue of the Times, which looks at Measure HHH-funded construction in the city of L.A. and whether the developers of those units should be required to allow people who've been homeless to bring their pets with them into those units. Carla Hall, editorial writer for the Times, good to have you with us this morning.
Nice to be here.
So share with us what the council or committee is going to be taking up on this. Is this something typically left to developers to decide?
It is typically left to developers to decide, just like it would be with market rate housing. But the city feels, because it has some control over subsidized financing, HHH financing, and affordable managed pipeline financing, that they can require developers to have a pet policy with rules and regulations. But the idea is to encourage developers to not have one more barrier for people who are desperate for housing and have probably had a pretty hard time getting housing.
So this, as I understand it, if a developer, a building owner, takes HHH funding for a building, then for any of those units that are covered by HHH construction funds, they would have to allow pets. But I wonder if it's a mixed building, if you've got one where you've got some people with market rate, or maybe they're getting some other sort of, you know, public assistance, not HHH, and it's a mixed residence, could you end up with HHH residents able to have pets and those living there under different funding mechanisms or market rate not being allowed pets? Could that happen?
Well, that's a good question. I can't imagine the optics of it looking very...
No.
most of the HHH projects that I can think of that have gotten funded were all entirely HHH projects, or they had a mix of HHH and senior housing and sort of populations that were need a little bit of help as opposed to market rate housing. It's a good question, though, and the city council might want to consider it, or housing officials that are overseeing HHH disbursement of funds might want to look into it. I mean, I would certainly suggest that if you're taking funding from the city for subsidized units, that you extend the pet policy across the whole building.
What about limits on that? I mean, do you think it would be appropriate for there to be some limits that would be set for number of pets, for the care of pet? I mean, because I could see where there might be other residents be concerned about if the pet isn't, you know, well kept and healthy and things like that. Do you think there could be those requirements, or would that be perceived as being insulting to the formerly homeless resident?
Not at all. Most buildings that have pet policies or allow pets also have pet rules and regulations. And in fact, I believe the ordinance that the city is considering says there will be rules. There could be rules on number of pets. There could be rules on types of pets, cats and dogs, like common household pets. I can't imagine any of these buildings are going to allow you to have a snake, for instance. I think there should be rules on how you take care of your pet, that you need to clean up after your pet in common spaces and probably in the unit itself. You need to have the pet be well behaved and do something about the pet if the pet's not well behaved. I think these are all common sense rules, and I think any regulation that the city puts in
to place could accommodate all those rules.
We're talking with Carla Hall, editorial writer for the LA Times. She wrote the Times editorial board piece that advocates for the LA City Council banning a ban on pets in any of the units that are constructed with HHH funding, those funds intended for people who've been homeless to be able to be housed. I'd like to hear your thoughts about this. And, you know, if you're in the development community, I'd be interested in that as well as someone who's been homeless, perhaps. I don't see much value in debating the value of pets to someone who's homeless. I think that's something we can agree on, that having a pet is a positive for many people, whether homeless or not, and that that companionship, that responsibility for the pet can be a very valuable thing. The question is, should the city put that requirement on any recipient of those HHH development funds? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with us, the executive director of the Southern California Association of Nonprofit Housing, Alan Greenlee. Thank you, sir, for joining us.
Great to be back with you, Larry. Thank you.
Do you have any concerns about the city mandating this, that pets must be allowed?
I think there's some things to consider for sure. Before I respond to your question, I want to make sure to express my appreciation for the great work that KPCC has done and the LA Times has done, particularly the editorial section, the reporting section on the shining the light on housing affordability in our region, particularly around the homelessness question. So thank you both.
Thank you
for your great work on that. As it relates to the, you know, the motion at City Council, you know, it's a little bit of a pivot as a matter of public policy. There have been federal policy in place. There are state policies in place that have to do with making accommodations for residents who have service and companion animals. And our developers have been in compliance with those rules for some time. The question of allowing pets is a little bit different question. It sort of makes a broader range of animals that can be brought into housing, and it has a number of implications that you guys have discussed already about the rules and regulations with respect to what kind of animals should be allowed, making sure that they're properly vaccinated. But I think that there are some additional concerns associated with kind of more liberalizing the definition of eligible animals. And so, for example, in a supportive housing context, there are a number of residents who may have animals, whether they're, you know, pets or service companion animals, but there are also residents or likely residents who have either health concerns associated with cohabitating in an environment with animals, or may have just straight up, fear and anxiety around having animals present. And those things need to be considered in the context of the ordinance. And I think probably the most important thing for listeners to think about as a matter of public policy is that to the extent that we include animals in affordable housing, pets in affordable housing, there's a serious potential of increased costs, whether it be maintenance to the building, insurance and liability expenses, other kinds of, facility expenses with respect to retaining the animals and whatnot. And those expenses have a direct impact on the cost of the building, which has an impact on the number of units.
Yeah, I didn't even think about the liability insurance issue. You did anticipate, though, my next question to you was going to be, as I understand, in many rentals, people put down a security deposit or a cleaning deposit if the pet is accepted, so that if the pet does property damage, the owner would have, you know, some sort of funds to draw on to do the remediation after the tenant moves out. But in this case, you'd have people moving in. They wouldn't have the resources to put down that kind of a deposit, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think you run into a challenge on the fiscal side just for the residents who are moving in.
Carla Hall, you have any thoughts on that challenge and how to deal with that?
I think that is an issue. These are poor people, and they're not going to have a lot of money for a pet deposit, but there should be a pet deposit. Alan's right that there are going to be wear and tear issues, and the owners need to have some way to have money for that. I think that there should be pet deposits. There may be a way the city can subsidize that. And I understand, then you start doing the math and thinking, well, how much is that going to cost? That's an issue to look at, but I think that could be resolved. And as has already been said, there are already animals in lots of buildings because they're emotional support animals and service animals. And presumably those animals sometimes cause a certain amount of wear and tear on units, and developers or landlords have to deal with it.
Let's talk next with Carrie in Culver City. Carrie, you're on Air Talk.
Hi. I think that the it doesn't sound like anyone's talking about how much it can cost when someone's dog bites another person. Those cases can come up with tens, 20, even hundreds of thousands of dollars against property owners or people among the buildings. And I think that's something that needs to be considered. Property owners may be on the hook for that, or it might be something they just don't want to have in their buildings. So it can be really damaging when someone gets bit by a dog, nerve damage, all kinds of things. And making someone be forced to take on that responsibility, I don't hear that being discussed.
And this is something, Carrie, I think you were just calling in as Alan Greenlee was making the point about liability insurance. And Carla Hall, one of the challenges here in the trade-offs is if the city is going to, you know, take on the cost of cleaning deposit or is going to in some way subsidize for higher liability insurance or deal with, you know, that sort of thing, is that the best use of limited funds above and beyond, you know, funding the actual creation of units?
I think that's a good question. I think the whole reason to allow pets is to enhance the quality of life of the people living there. And I think particularly with homeless people who are moving into supportive housing, who are going to need a lot of help and services to get themselves together so that they can pursue a more successful life. I think the pet can be seen as something that will help them in that quest toward a normal life.
So almost like you're investing in a form of therapy.
In a way, yeah. Alan may disagree with that, but...
Yeah.
I think that's one way to look at it.
Animals in my house. I'm a big fan of pets. So I totally agree with that. I just, you know, that Larry, you sort of highlighted the distinction, which is in this crisis that we're in, when we really do need to sort of figure out a way to get people off of the street, is expanding the range of what's allowable in a building to pets as opposed to service or companion animals worth the dollar trade-off. I mean, that's the public policy question we're asking.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really difficult issue with strong arguments on both sides. Because again, I think none of us are going to say, there are no consequences to banning pets for people who've been homeless when these have been their closest companions in so many cases for years. I mean, that just is to deny the emotional reality of what people are living with. On the other hand, you're raising real financial consequences of this, and then you get into finite funds and what's the trade-off there. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. I welcome your thoughts on where you think this should be. But let me ask you, Alan Greenlee, do you think if the council required the acceptance of pets, that would have a chilling effect on people taking HHH funds, or would it not reach that level of an impediment?
Well, I think speaking on behalf of my members, which are predominantly mission-driven, nonprofit development companies, they're in this business not to make money, but to address the public policy or social concern. And so my guys will figure it out. They will figure out a way to house people coming off the streets. But the question is the is the trade-off, the financial trade-off, really worth it? I think, you know, one of the things Carla mentioned in her editorial today was this notion of, you know, the people living on the streets who currently have animals and then separate from the animal, which creates a chilling effect of, about people moving in. And I would just say, as a matter of policy,
right. Yeah.
Most public support, permanent supportive housing, we take people in regardless. So we're taking people in who are drug addicted, who have not kicked their habits. And so it's really a sort of a housing first model. And so I think this notion of pets sort of strikes at that too. So it's a tough question.
All right. Yeah, I want to thank you both so much for wading into what is a very difficult and important issue. That was Alan Greenlee, Executive Director of the Southern California Association of Nonprofit Housing, and Carla Hall, editorial writer for the LA Times, who wrote today on this very issue. You can share your comments, what you think, on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Coming up, we continue with a focus on housing. This time, the homeless of Orange County and those who were living in encampments along the Santa Ana River. We'll talk about what their fate looks like in the months to come right after this. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. U.S. District Judge David Carter has gotten a lot of attention over the Orange County homeless issue. The judge, when there were the encampments along the Santa Ana River, went out to look at it. He tried to come up with a plan with the cities and counties involved with housing the people there. But the question is, what's become of those hundreds of individuals who were living along the river? For a while, they were in motels where they were able to give vouchers for their stays. With us to update us on where things stand is KPCC Orange County reporter Jill Replogle. Jill, good morning. Appreciate
Hi.
It. So where do we stand with Judge Carter's oversight of this and the plan?
You know, it's really it's an interesting court case. It kind of has two aspects. So there are the people that were living at the riverbed who were put into this motel program. That's about 700 people. And the judges have basically, or sorry, not the judges, the lawyers for the homeless have sort of been working on individual cases with those people. A lot of people have been kicked out of various programs, often for, you know, small infractions or you know, there's a lot of people in one motel in Anaheim that have mental health issues. And there have been some problems there with people being kicked out for things that the lawyers don't believe they should have been kicked out for. So, you know, a lot of we don't have numbers. No one has kept strict numbers, but a lot of people have ended up back on the street. Some people are doing really well. Some people have found housing. I've been following one couple that is working really hard to get themselves housing. But, you know, that is a huge weak point in the system is getting people to that ultimate point where they have a permanent roof over their heads. And then sort of the other side of the lawsuit is about trying to set up a system in Orange County whereby there really are enough shelter beds to keep people off the streets, you know, when they fall into homelessness.
And is Carter overseeing that part of it,
yes,
too? Okay.
He has been mostly focused on that part. And this last hearing that happened last Friday was really him getting down to the numbers and saying, look, these are how many beds I want to see come online in the northern part of the county, in the central part of the county, and the southern part of the county. And basically, he's given cities until, I believe it's September 7th, the next hearing, to figure that out. And we heard some progress on Friday on that. There are apparently a number of shelters that are sort of in the pipeline that city councils are looking at and, you know, working on trying to get the property secured and then get the votes to make that happen. And then there are some areas that we still sort of don't know, like in South County especially. There has not been at least a public proposal of where to put beds there. The judge wants 300 new shelter beds in the south part of Orange County, and it's unclear whether cities are going to come up with that.
And the proposal to house several hundred people at part of the Great Park in Irvine, is that now dead?
That's dead.
Okay, because of busloads of people from Irvine who went to...
And that's the problem. You know, the other interesting thing is the sites of the shelters that have been proposed and, you know, even in this court hearing, there were various, you know, local officials that came up and said, well, we've got this, you know, we have 300 beds in this spot that we think we can have. And they're keeping the actual site locations very quiet, I think in large part because they don't want a big backlash.
KPCC Orange County reporter Jill Replogle with us on Air Talk. I'd love to hear from you if you're an Orange County resident. You have some ideas about how the county and local cities can deal with the numbers of people that are homeless in the county. We're at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-KPCC. 5722. So, Jill, we don't even know the cities where these beds are contemplated.
We know the cities. There's a very large shelter that's proposed for Santa Ana, 700 beds. They want to close down the Courtyard, which is the county's really only low barrier shelter right now that houses about 400 people in downtown Santa Ana. There have been a lot of concerns expressed by the judge and by lawyers for the plaintiffs, homeless plaintiffs in this case, about that facility, about it not being ADA compliant, being overcrowded. There are about 425 people on a given night in that place. So they're trying to open a larger shelter in Santa Ana. Anaheim has also said that they have two places that they're trying to get going. One, I think, is 200 beds, and the other something like 75 to 100. Those are kind of the most concrete places, and there are a few other smaller ones that city officials got
so
up and spoke about
county.
It. But yeah, central and a lot of it sort of central. The county's divided into these three service planning areas, but when you get to sort of, you know, Orange, Santa Ana, Anaheim, which are technically in the north and the central, they're all very close together.
Well, and I haven't been down there in a few months, but the county seat there with the county building, Santa Ana, is there still a large homeless population on the street there?
On the street, yes. They cleared out the large encampment that was in the Plaza of the Flags as part of this lawsuit. The judge, you know, said, I want this cleared out. But when you walk around there, and I do often, there are still
there's still there in the neighborhood.
A lot of people, yes.
All right. Jill Replogle, KPCC Orange County reporter. Let me bring into the conversation Carol Sobel, a frequent guest with us on Air Talk, the civil rights attorney who represents homeless Southern Californians, including Orange County. Carol, good to have you with us again.
Good to be here.
So what's your sense of the progress being made on coming up with these beds?
Well, I think Jill's report was very accurate. I am pretty confident that Anaheim is going to meet what it said to the court it had, including the 200 beds. The original goal for that 200-bed site, which is not an emergency drop-in shelter, it's a more of a transitional facility, and I think that is part of the recognition that the emergency shelters aren't really helping people move to the next step. So this is more of a transitional facility. It is being developed by a private property owner who will then work with the city and potentially the county as well, but at least with the city of Anaheim, to operate it. That is pretty much certain at this point. It still needs to be finalized somewhat. And I think the expectation is that we'll be up and running sometime by probably early next year, probably late January, early February. Originally, it was intended to be up and running by December, but, you know, the government powers that be were hesitant to do it. It's a really good model. I think people are going to be really excited when they see it. It's comprehensive, and it's a really good model.
And has that location in Anaheim been announced?
No.
Okay, so that's being kept quiet.
It's an industrial location, so it's not a residential location.
Okay.
I want to be really clear about that.
All right.
The other Anaheim properties, I think that property has been announced. I know that in a prior court hearing, it's really the Salvation Army, and they already have a facility in Anaheim. So I'm not sure if it's just expanding that facility or if there's a nearby facility as well. But everybody pretty much knows that's the Salvation Army. The Santa Ana facility, what happened in court last week was the judge wanted to be certain that the memorandum of understanding between Santa Ana and the county, which are jointly going to be involved with that project, was completed and the project could move forward. It is not a 700-unit emergency shelter, as I understand it, or at least as it was originally presented to us. It is a multi-level facility. It's a very large piece of property, again, in an industrial area, and it provides the opportunity to have both a low-barrier drop-in facility, transitional facility, areas for families with children, job training, and a variety of different, almost like a campus, so that it isn't, you know, it addresses the problems that we all see that exists with low barrier emergency shelters.
What's the capacity proposed there?
Well, the original capacity was 700, and then in a status report, I think, or something that they provided to the judge, they had reduced that to 600, and the judge at court last Friday said there is no reason why that facility can't accommodate 700, particularly as it is going to have such a varied level of services available. Both the facilities, both the 200-person facility in Anaheim and the 700 facilities, have wraparound services built into them.
All right. Carol Sobel, civil rights attorney, joining us. Also with us, Todd Wolfson, managing partner at Carruthers, DeSante & Freudenberger in Irvine, specializes in employment and labor law, and he's been legal counsel for a number of the Orange County cities that had been proposed sites for homeless housing. Todd, good to have you with us again.
Thanks, Larry.
Where do the cities stand now on some of these new proposals? Are there still concern, particularly in the South County cities you represent, that they don't necessarily want these facilities there?
Well, I don't know that the cities per se don't want the shelters there. It's just the constituents and the people that live within the cities have understandable concerns. I mean, if you look at the Santa Ana Riverbed when they came in and kind of swept out all the people that were living there. I mean, they found thousands of used hypodermic syringes, hundreds of pounds of human waste, fecal waste, and several tons of trash. The reporting on this and people see, you know, obviously the sensationalized information, and their reaction is, oh, my God, I don't want that in my backyard. And the cities have an obligation to the constituents, and the cities kind of become punching bags in this. On the one hand, you've got a brilliant jurist, David Carter, who's saying, look, this needs to get fixed. But his fundamental assumption is that all of the people that are currently homeless looking for shelters actually want and will go into the shelters. And there's just not a whole lot of information out there supporting that as to what the percentage of people that, you know, that will actually go into the shelters. So the cities are being forced to spend a lot of money litigating, spend a lot of money in some kind of a settlement, putting together a shelter, and then running the risk that their local residents are either going to be upset with them, perhaps next time there's an election cycle, or they'll file lawsuits because they're blaming crime or, you know, nefarious activity that happens in their neighborhood on the city's quote-unquote negligent action by allowing the shelter where they put it in. So
yeah,
cities are kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Joe Rep Local?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I think one of the arguments from some of the cities in South Orange County are some cities that just don't feel like they have a big homeless population. And the numbers that the judge has come up with are basically based on the point in time count, which is this count that they go out and do, you know, one day and count homeless people. But, you know, it's kind of an approximation. And so, and the way that they divided up those numbers is, it's an approximation. And so a lot of cities have pushed back saying, look, we don't have a homeless population. And what Judge Carter has said is, well, one, just on you know, people not wanting services, he says that's nonsense. He has, you know, he showed a video in court on Friday where he went around and was talking to people on the street and asking them about services. And, you know, and they all said,
of course, those are two different things, what people say and then
right.
When it comes down to it.
Yeah,
what they
of
do.
Course. But, you know, but Judge Carter thinks that's nonsense. But the other thing he said is, look, if Anaheim and Santa Ana step up with these shelters and they are able to get out of this lawsuit and we can go back to letting police kick people out of the parks and the sidewalks and street corners, they will go south. They will go to where you can't do that, which might be those cities that have refused to or, you know, not been able to come up with a place for shelter. So that's been his sort of, you know, threat, I guess.
Let's take a listener call, Janet in Costa Mesa. Janet, your thoughts on this?
Well, as a business owner in Costa Mesa, one of the concerns that we have is that the business community very rarely seems to be invited to the table to have any of these discussions. Certainly the general community, you know, does their protest and their outrage and so forth. But the business community is impacted by people experiencing homelessness on a daily basis. I mean, you show up for work and there's people on your doorstep. There's things that they left behind from sleeping in your parking lot the night before. There is the criminal element, although not all, you know, homeless are involved in crime. But the business community, especially here in Costa Mesa, one of the cities involved in the lawsuit, you know, we face this on a daily basis. And I've been following Judge Carter's, progress through the courts. And, you know, we have a lot of services that we offer here. But, you know, when I hear that they're, you know, planning on putting all these shelters in industrial areas, while that may solve the community aspect of it, you know, in the morning when the shelters close down, these people start heading out into the business community. So, you know, there needs to be, I think, a much broader approach to some of these locations, because just taking them out of the communities and away from schools doesn't necessarily always solve the problem.
Janet, thank you so much. We really appreciate your sharing a business perspective from Costa Mesa. We're, of course, going to revisit this issue because just a month away from the deadline for the plans to be presented for the number of housing units that Judge Carter is mandating. My thanks to our guests, Carol Sobel, Jill Replogle, KPCC Orange County reporter, who's going to be providing you with that coverage on a regular basis, as she has for months, and Todd Wolfson, who's represented as legal counsel a number of Southern California cities, been dealing with the legal issues surrounding homelessness. Coming up on Air Talk, we take a look at Alex Jones and his InfoWars various sites being removed from Facebook, his podcast removed from Spotify, and other places, him being kicked off social media. We'll talk about what the response has been from conservatives to that move, back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurtis. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this afternoon on All Things Considered, I know I don't want to miss this segment, millions of relics of Black Americana are stored in the California desert. That's right. We're going to hear about how this enormous collection came to be. That's on All Things Considered with Nick Roman this afternoon on 89.3 KPECC. Early yesterday morning, Facebook made the announcement that it was removing a number of accounts off of its platform that were related to conspiracy theorist Alex Jones and his InfoWars podcasts. Apple removed 5 of the 6 podcasts that InfoWars creates. Also, YouTube removing a number of videos, and Spotify removing the podcasts as well. This follows concerns that conservatives have expressed that a number of social media platforms have used the argument of hate speech as a way of removing some conservative content. But the Alex Jones case really complicates it, because very few conservatives are going to be defenders of the content put out by Alex Jones. With us to talk about the move and what it means about the role that social media takes in removing content is USC Professor of Communication Larry Gross. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Sure thing.
So what are your thoughts about these various platforms, one after the other, ejecting Jones?
Well, the first thing to note is that the removal of or blocking of political or other sites has been happening on the left for a while. So it's not that this is the first time that the social media companies have been seen as exercising judgment that is controversial on political grounds. The left has been complaining about this for a while, and other groups as well. I mean, as a gay man, I'm well aware of the history of removal or blocking of content seen as controversial because it simply dealt with gay lives. So to some extent, this is a familiar issue. And the larger point really is that our laws and our practices have not yet caught up with social media. History of legislation and other practices around what is or is not acceptable to be published in the public sphere really predates the advent of social media, and it's going to take a while for us as a society and for our legal and other systems to figure out how to deal with this new phenomenon.
One of the things that I think would have been helpful was if Facebook could have said, for example, here are the postings that we clearly consider violations in our terms of service, either that they are an incitement to violence, whether they engage in hate speech against particular groups, because I think everybody who knows anything about Alex Jones understands the extreme nature of the speech that he engages in. But still, it would be helpful to know about the timing of this, for example. What is it that, you know, he's recently posted or said that led to this move? Would you support that, Professor, the specifics being cited?
Well, sure. I mean, it's helpful. It's my understanding from what I've read about this that there have been cases where, or instances where, Jones has violated terms of service. I don't know whether it was Facebook or Google with YouTube or others, that there have been instances where that have been violated, and yet these practices have continued. So I think there are some examples. But the larger point here is that the scope of social media, YouTube, Facebook, and these others, is so extraordinary now that the expectation that any company can list or deal with them, you know, one at a time, is unrealistic. That's part of the challenge here. Facebook and others dealing with these fake news issues that we're now so familiar with are scrambling around to try and figure out how to respond to a wave, you know, with a bucket. They're completely outnumbered by the amount of material involved.
USC Communications Professor Larry Gross is with us. Also from DePaul University in Indiana, Professor of Communication, columnist for The Hill, Jeffrey McCall. Jeff, good to have you with us again.
Thank you very much.
So your thoughts, I mean, I don't mean by bringing up the conservative concerns about what they say is censorship that you've got a lot of conservative defenders of Alex Jones, but do you have any concerns about Jones being kicked off these platforms?
Well, it's hard to be sympathetic with Alex Jones given his extremist points of view, but I do think that we need to look at this broader issue in ways that go way beyond Alex Jones. And I also think we need to look at this as not just simply conservative speech or liberal speech, that in a sense this goes beyond politics, because we really have here, I think, a principle of free expression, which is rooted in the First Amendment, versus the circumstance that is Alex Jones. And the First Amendment was set up, you know, by our founders to create a functional interdependence where basically we would all put up with some extreme speech that we probably don't like in order to defend the benefits of free speech on a more broader sense for everybody to have that right. And so I would encourage folks when looking at this issue to try to not just look at, is Alex Jones an extremist or does he have conspiracies out there or has he made outlandish claims, but to look at, you know, what do we do to manage the public sphere? And Professor Gross was exactly right. The social media have exploded in such a way over the years that as a society and including our legal system, we don't really have a good handle on how to deal with this. And I agree with the question you raised, Larry, too, in that the tech companies have not been very clear with what their standards are going to be. And I think that's one thing we're going to have to look for, is that these tech companies are going to have to come through with some very specific and transparent rules, because it's not enough to just say, oh, this was an extreme view, or this was false, or this dehumanized, because when you get right down to it, the internet and social media are filled with all of this kind of stuff.
Well, and let me ask you, I mean, this may seem extreme, but should these companies be in the business of removing stuff that's false?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Tech companies have positioned themselves over the years as open platforms for everyone. But now, of course, they're taking some heat because they have allowed that to happen. And so they now want to undertake what is really, I think, going to be a mammoth task to try to sensibly referee all the content that's out there and make decisions as to who gets taken down or who's going to be censored or whatever. And I think that's in some ways an impossible task, but also in other ways a dangerous path, because, you know, you can censorship goes down a very downward spiral very quick, and it has to be carefully measured. And that's not to say these tech companies don't want to be socially responsible and, you know, hold up some standards for our society. But I think there's another point where they maybe underestimate the capacity of sensible people to assess and reject extreme views. And I think for the tech companies to put themselves in this position of refereeing, they're going to have to expand their staffs,
right,
you know, multiple times to get enough people in there to go through all the various places where they're going to find extreme stuff. And I think that problem right now is what gives the defenders of Alex Jones the right to say, you're picking on us when all this other stuff is out there.
I want to hear what Professor Gross at USC has to say about that as we continue. We're talking about multiple social media platforms tossing Alex Jones and his InfoWars sites off of those platforms, citing hate speech and incitement to violence. The question is, on the broader issue, should social media platforms be making the determinations about what's true or false? And then what are the criteria for determining that something is an incitement to violence or that it qualifies as hate speech? We're at 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Tony writes on the Air Talk page, private companies are free to use their products any way they want. There's no First Amendment issue here. In fact, Twitter's been shadow banning conservatives for at least a year, and their business is gradually failing. Let the market work. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Sandman writes on the page, another import, YouTube was already censoring Jones. YouTube currently puts certain offensive channels, mostly if not all conservative leaning, into restricted modes where they can't use Google ads, don't show in recommended videos, etc. The tech giants are on a full-on war to shape public opinion. Jones was not the first, most definitely will not be the last. What happened to the original vision of the Internet? That's Sandman writing on the Air Talk page. USC communication professor Larry Gross, let me ask you about, you know, are you comfortable with these tech company platforms being arbiters about what's true, what's false, and what is hate speech?
Well, no. I think the power of these tech companies is one of the biggest threats right now that, you know, we face as a society, because it has grown, you know, incredibly, and you know, with sort of little oversight of any sort. And censorship is never going to be the answer for the reasons that we are all familiar with and that your other guest just, you know, just described. That's a very dangerous slope to start sliding down. The point I was making earlier is that this has been going on for a long time. Alex Jones has just raised the profile of it, and we are going to have to figure out as a society, we really need to, how to think about and deal with social media. Alex Jones, I think, will be taken care of in a way through the court system. I think the defamation suit against Alex Jones that's currently in play is likely to be successful, because the Sandy Hook parents whom he has targeted are not, I don't think, going to be defined as public figures in the way that, you know, the Sullivan and post-Sullivan decisions have implied. And I think the damages they have suffered from Alex Jones and his followers are likely to succeed in court. At least I hope they do. And in a way, that will be the answer, ultimately, that sort of recourse, rather than giving even more power to social media companies. The only point I make about social media companies is not to allow Alex Jones and his defenders to act as if this hasn't been happening before, and that it hasn't happened much more to the left than it ever has to the right.
What are some examples of some of the Facebook or other social media censoring or removing of sites on the left?
I can't, you know, come up with examples off the top of my head, but any of your listeners can quickly Google and find. Just look up. I think there are lots of examples where people have shown that organizations or individuals that are viewed as political controversial. I mean, as you know, as you've said, has been said, these are commercial companies. Their primary concern is, you know, is their bottom line and how they're perceived by the public as a whole. And there's always been more sensitivity to speech that is viewed as coming from the left than to the right.
Jeff McCall, do you agree with that?
Oh, I think Professor Gross is exactly right, that there's always been a lot of pressure from all sources out there. And historically, he's, I think, correct that there's been more pressure from the left than the right. But in this day and age, we're probably going to see a little bit of the swinging of that. And I think one of the things that's important to say here is that really nobody out there is an absolutist when it comes to free speech. Everybody, I mean, has a dark side where they would prefer to have some things not said or some voices silenced. And the issue here with Alex Jones is that, you know, the tech services can get in there and start wrestling with Alex Jones or whatever, but it's not going to stop fake news. It's not going to stop extreme views. These problems are not going to go away. And if anything, they may be served to raise the visibility of Alex Jones this week by their motions rather than to just try to manage it and go away, hope it goes away. And one other thing I'd say, there's this notion that everybody wants to silence somebody else. There's a new poll out just this week that shows that 43% of Republicans think that President Trump should have the authority to close news outlets that are engaged in bad behavior. And I think as a society, this is a very bad trend for us to think that we're going to shut up extreme websites and we're going to give the president the authority to close down news outlets. And I think we all need to step back and think, what has made our society function for over 200 years? And that is by allowing people to have their say and by being willing to respect opposing points of view, no matter how crazy they are, and letting the marketplace
start this thing out. Wow. Jeff, I'm stunned by that. The poll results you cited, because I assume a high percentage of those Republicans would decry what we hear from some progressives that, you know, the First Amendment goes too far and should be constrained.
Yeah.
I mean, that's totally inconsistent.
Well, today released and reported in The Hill.
All right. Caroline in West Hollywood says, we have to consider that sometimes it's difficult to discern what is a fake site. A lot of the sites can be convincing yet subtle. The censoring of fake sites is a good thing for those of us who can't decipher real from fake. Caroline, I would just say you trust the social media platforms to be the ones to make that call. Maybe it'd be better if we're all skeptical about what we read and see and do further research to try and confirm or debunk what we see. Brian in Sherman Oaks says these are private companies. They're entitled to ban whatever they want from their platforms. This isn't like governmental censoring of speech. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. My thanks to Jeffrey McCall, DePauw University Professor of Communications and columnist for The Hill, and Larry Gross, USC Professor of Communications. Have a wonderful afternoon. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up next, and I'm looking forward to talking with you tomorrow morning at 10, when in our first hour, the CEO of Metro, Phil Washington, one of our most popular guests on the program, he'll be with us and take your questions. Have a great day.